Informed Choice Radio, episode 492, Misfits Changing Finance Forever with Daniel Simon.
Live from Sundial House Studios, this is Informed Choice Radio. Want to make the most of your money and your life? You've come to the right place. Now, here's your host, Martin Bamford.
Every day, financial technology, or fintech, is creating seismic changes within the banking and finance sector. My guest today is author of the dramatic story of fintech's major players, exploring how these disruptions are transforming even money itself. Dan Simon is chairman of the Museum of American Finance Communications Board and CEO of Vested, a global financial communications firm. He represents some of the most recognizable brands in finance and fintech, including Morgan Stanley, Bloomberg, and Goldman Sachs. Dan is author of The Money Hackers, focusing on some of fintech's most powerful disruptors. He describes these disruptors as a ragtag collection of financial outsiders and savants telling their incredible stories to explain how the technology works and how it's changing the entire industry. Here's my conversation with Daniel Simon, author of The Money Hackers, in episode 492 of Informed Choice Radio. So welcome to Informed Choice Radio. Dan, perhaps you could start by introducing yourself. Tell us a little bit about you and who you are, what you do.
Ooh, that is such a good question. It's the one that's the hardest to answer. So I'm Daniel P. Simon. If you're looking for me on the internet, you'll find me Daniel P. Simon, but you can call me Dan. Only my mother really calls me Daniel. And I am a writer and a speech writer and a communications guy that spent most of my life on Wall Street. So finance, everything that money touches, from government policy down to the money in people's wallets, is kind of what's fascinated me. And I've made a career out of writing stories about it.
And our sort of eagle-eared listeners will pick up the fact that you don't have a US accent.
So Bronx accent? You didn't notice my thick Bronx accent?
No.
No, I've actually spent more time in the States than I have anywhere else in my life. I'm a bit of a global mutt. I grew up not far from you. I was born in Brixton and grew up in sort of Southwest London. I traveled around. I went to school in Switzerland and I came out here for business. And I came out here very young, in my early 20s. Boston was my first home, which is why I'm still a diehard Red Sox and Pats fan. And now New York is my home, and it has been for nearly 20 years.
And we're going to be talking...
See how I did that? I said 20 years.
20, it slipped in.
There's no T on the 20. 20.
But we're going to be talking today about your book, The Money Hackers. We're talking about fintech. So let's start there with fintech. What is fintech for the uninitiated?
So it means lots of different things. I've been working in fintech. I like to say I was working in fintech before fintech was sexy. So when I first started, every industry has technology involved in it. There's nothing that we do today that isn't. And then there's a common refrain that every company is a technology company. And that's more true today than ever. So finance has always had technology. Money is its own form of technology, actually. And actually, the banking industry was a big purchaser of financial technology. It wasn't called fintech then when I started. It was called financial technology. And if you wanted to shut down a conversation at a dinner party, you would just tell them that you worked in financial technology. And that was like two boring words combined. And people walked away from you very quickly. Today, you tell them you work in fintech and they want your help setting up their Venmo or their Monzo accounts or something. And they want to know the best, the coolest apps to download. So the tables have turned. But back when I was doing it, it was just a business of selling technology to banks. What we understand as fintech today is something different. It's a generation of people who didn't grow up inside finance, who are using technology to try and help people better manage their money, and whether that's savings or sending it to people or sending it across borders or investing for their future or buying a house or saving up for college and university, all of that requires money. And fintech, as we understand it today, is just the application of technology to solve some of these challenges.
And that to me is particularly interesting, because when we think about money and the finance sector, we often think about a very traditional sector, you know, people who have been bankers their entire lives. But increasingly with fintech companies, these are non-finance people, often younger people who have come from a different direction. So is that a fair categorization of the sector? Is it outsiders, interlopers who are coming in and disrupting the world of finance?
Yeah, I call them misfits in my book. So the book title is The Money Hackers, How a Group of Misfits Took on Wall Street and Changed Finance Forever. And you know, whether you call them outsiders or interlopers, I think I didn't call them outsiders because some of them had grown up inside the financial industry. But even those, the word misfit is a better word, I think, because you take someone like Blythe Masters, you know, she's the quintessential financial person. She's a Brit originally, rose to become the CFO of JP Morgan on their investment banking side, and you know, ended up sort of becoming the poster child for the financial crisis. But she never really fit in. She's sort of one foot in, one foot out, partly because she's a woman and it wasn't a very accommodating industry for women, and partly because she's just smarter than the white, boring finance men around her, and more humble and just more brilliant in a way. And so she's a misfit. Even the ones that may have had finance on their resume that helped bring fintech to bear, and I agree, a lot of them were not from inside finance. Some of them were from way off. And I'm happy to talk about some of those people because they're all fascinating. Mm-hmm. But even the ones that came from inside never really fit in a way because of the color of their skin or their gender or their opinions or their ideas. So yes, in that regard, they're all outsiders. Even the insiders were outsiders.
And what attracted them to the world of finance and finance technology? I mean, is it the simple answer, money? Or was there more to it?
I mean, the new generation of fintech entrepreneurs, money, if you mean
financial
personal enrichment, was really one of the motivators. I think some of the motivators are what attracts all entrepreneurs to something, which is an inquisitiveness about changing things. So like, for example, the founder of a company we have here called Lending Club, which is a publicly traded peer-to-peer lender. He was a guy called Renaud Laplanche. He was a technologist. He wasn't a finance guy. And one day he got and he's French, as you might assume with a name like Renaud Laplanche. And he gets a credit card bill one day, and he starts looking at it, and he's just thinking, like, you know, I guess he had a bank statement in one hand and a credit card bill in the other. And he's like, so I lend you money. I give you my money and you give me whatever paltry, you know, rate of return is on that. Right. So I lend to you at 1%. You lend to me at 7%. And he says, you know, I was an outsider in two ways. I was a technologist, but I was also French. So that disagreed with my egalitarian view of the way that it just seemed unfair to his Frenchness. He was living in New York at the time. And so he kind of started to wonder, well, what is the spread? Why is there this difference between what I lend to you and what you lend back to me? And the answer is infrastructure. And so he thought, well, what if we could build, you know, a technology that cuts out some of that infrastructure, the branches, the bricks and mortar, the employees, and you know, be able to pass more, you know, better rates onto the savers and better returns onto the lenders. And so, you know, that's how he came about it. Just pure inquisitiveness. Why is it broken? How do I change it? Right. So Bobby Kennedy said famously, you know, some people look at the world and they ask why. I look at the way it could be and I ask why not. And so just straight up inquisitiveness. And you see this in every industry, healthcare, it doesn't matter, entertainment, you know, you name it. There's always someone who's like, well, why do we do it that way? Why can't we do it differently? The other thing that motivated a lot of these guys was, as I said, that sense of fairness. For the most part, the what you called at the outset, the sort of stodgy, traditional view of finance has a lot of problems associated with it, engineered complexity. And if you find that it seems overly complex, that's because it wasn't built for you. You know, it's not made for you. You weren't supposed to be there, you, whoever the listener is, right? You're not, that wasn't for you. Tax optimization isn't for you, you know? And it's always been this sort of secret club. And yet the power of the essential power of financial services is incredibly democratic and incredibly positive, right? I'm on the board of the communications board at the Museum of American Finance, and our CEO there, Dr. David Cowan, you know, says if we could just get people to understand compound interest, we'd be halfway there, right? When asked what the most powerful force in the universe was, Albert Einstein said compounding interest. You know, there's something magical about finance. It's a technology for moving money backwards and forwards in time. You know, when you get a mortgage, you're borrowing money from your future self. And when you, when you save for retirement, you're taking money and you're sending it into the future to the person that's going to need it, you know, when you're old and frail. So there's something quite magical about the power of finance, but somehow that got perverted in the hallowed halls of banks, right, and asset managers. So there's this kind of David and Goliath. That's the other thing. It's the sort of technological curiosity, but also combined with this sense of democratization. And someone like John Stein, who created Betterment, which if you've got mostly UK listeners, would be like a nutmeg, a robo advisor. He's like, why does asset management work for, you know, just the wealthy? Why do I need to have £25,000 or dollars before I can start investing in the stock market? Why can't I start investing on dollar one? You know, and so there's that kind of like, that combines both of those things. One, sense of curiosity and a general kind of overarching sense of injustice and wanting to fix both of those things at the same time. Can I make it better and can I make it fairer at the same time? Money came second. Don't get me wrong, some of these guys ended up very rich. I think Ken Lin, who created Credit Karma, I think he's just sold it for like $5 billion. So he's not going to hurt for cash. But that's not usually, a lot of these guys didn't get into it to get rich.
No. And you mentioned an example there of a chap from France that was involved in the fintech sector. But from my perspective, it seems that fintech has really grown up around LA, San Francisco, and also around some parts of London. So are there reasons why we got these fintech hubs emerge around the world?
Well, I think fintech goes hand in hand with the tech part, right? So Silicon Roundabout in London, or Silicon Beach in LA, or Silicon Valley in San Francisco. And by the way, we have Silicon Alley in New York. So, you can't, I'm a mentor at something called Barclays Tech Stars, which is one of the world's sort of leading fintech incubators, and it's in New York and London. So we've got a thriving, to my colleagues in the fintech industry in New York, I don't want to suggest it doesn't exist there. It absolutely does. But, you know, wherever you've seen tech, it didn't necessarily originate in New York. You know, where you've seen technology sprout up, you've seen fintech, because so many of the fintech kind of pioneers are, so have a technologist's soul, if that makes sense. Even if they weren't sort of West Coast straight up technologists originally.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So how is this changing our lives? I mean, I think fintech is now, it's fairly pervasive. It's in all of our lives. We're using the apps, we're using the banks, etc. that use the fintech technology. But what impact is it having on our daily lives?
Well, I hope one for good. The answer to that sort of partly depends where in the world you are. Where you're sitting in Europe, you guys have actually been significantly ahead of the curve on a lot of what America is only coming to grips with. I mean, you've had things like peer-to-peer payment, you know, where two roommates can split the rent, you know, for 15 years, 10, 15 years. You'd be amazed to kind of realize that's pretty nascent here. We have a thing called Zelle, which is a consortium of the banks to enable peer-to-peer payment between individuals who may bank in different institutions. That's only 2 or 3 years old. It's pretty new. And so for a lot of people, there's been a lot of friction that is now getting solved, right? Splitting a pizza with friends, sending money to one another, sending money abroad, you know, getting better data about your money, accessing parts of the financial world like investments that were previously closed off to all but the wealthiest individuals. That's what technology has brought about for the vast majority of people. And it's sort of quite, in many ways, it's sort of insidious and pervasive. It's happened without kind of noticing. If you think about a shift in things like transport to like ride hailing, like Uber or Via or Lyft over here, you know, sometimes these changes happen quickly but subtly. And you realize one day you haven't taken a yellow cab or a black cab in like a year and a half. And you're like, oh my God. Or you haven't, you know, you use a, what do you have? You have DoorDash in the UK. We have Seamless and Grubhub here in the States. You know, you realize, when was the last time I looked at one of those shitty menus from a, you know, from a takeout and I, or a takeaway menu, and I called and had them deliver it. Like, I can't remember the last time that happened. Mm-hmm. And I think that same sort of rapid but subtle change is happening in our money. You know, and it bears, that's why I wrote the book, because it bears sort of standing back and realizing that 10 years ago, the, you know, investments were closed off to all but the most, the wealthy, or at least people with a minimum amount of money. There was a lot of friction between, you know, if you were trying to move money between people, things like sending money abroad, which in the States is less of an issue. It's just a very, very big country. It's the same reason Americans, I remember when I was a Brit, we used to make fun of Americans for not having passports. But you, when you live here, you realize it's a very, very large place. And so, you know, you can live in Hawaii, you can live in Florida, you live in the American Virgin Islands, you can live in Alaska. It's still America. But when, you know, to the immigrants that live here, you know, what's called remittances, sending money abroad, is a massive, massively important part of their lives. And for European people in EMEA region, it's Europe, Middle East, and Africa. It's remittances are a huge part of their GDP and their way of life. And again, 10 years ago, companies like Western Union were taking enormous chunks out of their paychecks every month. And today they're not, because technologies like World Remit and other remittance companies are using telco rails and using blockchain technology to sort of dramatically reduce the amount of money that they take and give back to people, to immigrants, hardworking immigrants who need to send that money abroad, a lot more money back to their families. So that's what the book is about. It's about how our lives have changed, even while we didn't realize it.
Yeah, and this idea of removing friction from financial transactions is a really, really good one. I mean, last week I had a check arrive in the post, and we have a lockdown situation here in the UK right now. I know you've got shelter in place in the US, etc. And I realized that I could pay in this check to my bank by scanning it through my banking app. Yeah. And I was getting very excited about this and sort of telling all my friends and things. I was like, well, that's been around for years. You could have done that ages ago. And I had no idea, but it was the sort of circumstances that forced me to explore what options were available and the fact I could use this tech to my benefit.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, more people in America have a mobile phone than a bank. So, you know, we still struggle with a massively underserved part of the population, and the barrier to that friction, which for us, you know, relatively cosmopolitan urban elites, you know, expresses itself as kind of, you know, moderate irritation, is for the bottom 50% of the population, life and death. Yeah. You know, access to credit, you know, for the vast majority of people in the UK and the US is no longer a luxury. It is absolutely key. If we're going to have a gig economy, if we're going to have a shift work economy, if we're essentially going to pass on the volatility of income from the employers to the employees, that is to say, you used to show up to a store, and whether the store sold anything or not, you drew a steady paycheck. And now, through the evil genius of Amazon's, you know, warehouse policies and tech tracking and, you know, Uber's apps, you know, we are able to say, oh, income volatility, that's your problem. That's not the employer's problem. In fact, I'm not even an employer at all. I'm like the strip club. You pay to come here, and you know what you make is yours. If we're going to live in a world like that, then we're going to have to address things like access to credit, because you know, again, as an urban elite, you and I use credit for things like purchasing very large things that we can't necessarily afford all in one go, like a house or a car or a fancy, you know, honeymoon. For the vast majority of people, at least for a plurality of people at the bottom third of society, credit is literally what smooths over the peaks and troughs of income volatility that society is forcing on them through a growing shift work economy and gig economy. Mm. And so, you know, for every pizza that we split on Venmo, right, there's that sort of like, oh, it was so convenient. Amazon, you know, drones the sushi into my mouth now. Right? For every, you know, for every, when we talk about technology, it's important to remember that, like, most of the readers of this book are going to experience these things as just making their lives a little bit easier. But there's an entire cohort of Western society where this shit is literally critical to their, you know, ongoing existence.
Mm, yeah, because so life or death stuff. Rather.
Life or death, yeah. It's not, you know, it's food or rent, that sort of thing. Mm. And in America, it's, you know, it's food or diabetes medication, insulin, and that's a whole separate thing. But we've architected, you know, for better or worse, we've architected societies that reward capital and penalize labor and income. And if we're going to live like that, we have to use technology to address the needs of the bottom 50% of our society. Because right now, we're just using technology to screw them. So Uber, you know, screws its drivers. Amazon screws its warehouse employees. Technology is only being used to actually disadvantage that segment of the population. FinTech believes that technology can be used to improve the lives of that population.
What are some of the FinTech innovations at the fringe that we may not have heard of that are, you know, probably the next wave of FinTech innovation, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my view of that is that there's the fancy stuff and then there's the sizzle and then there's the steak. Mm. You know what I mean? There's innovation theater and then there's the real stuff. And the real stuff is quite boring. So the sizzle stuff is things like blockchain and distributed ledger technology, right? You know, you've heard about the blockchain and you kind of know peripherally about this, your Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. And that's about as much as most people go. There's this fancy thing called blockchain. Mm. Somehow it's connected to this thing called Bitcoin. Some people got rich investing in Bitcoin, right? So underpinning all of that, the distributed ledger technology, the blockchain technology or Ethereum technology has enormous potential to solve some of the world's problems. Right. It can pass a lot of savings on to people. It can, you know, validate people in a really interesting way. So, for example, you know, land registry is a big issue in certain developing countries. They can't unlock the capital because they don't have accurate land registry. Blockchain, you know, can be used, is being used to solve, you know, some problems every day. I suspect that this current crisis that we're in right now will pause a lot of blockchain projects. It'll slow the rate of blockchain adoption. Blockchain is a bit like the internet, in as much as, you know, if you remember back as far as sort of 1996, you know, the internet was coming and everything they said about the internet was right. It was just 15 years too early, right? We didn't really realize, we didn't know what the internet was, and we didn't start to live our lives on the internet until, as we talk about in the book, the advent of the iPhone and really putting the internet in a workable way in our pockets in 2008. And then now we live in the internet, right? We can't. And blockchain will be the same thing. So this will probably slow some of that stuff. So if you want to sort of look in the fancy end of you know, what's around the corner you would talk to people like Michael Casey at MIT, who's also in the book, about the real promise of smart contracts and blockchain technology to transform venture capital and private equity and investment and solve some of the inequalities that I just talked about. But I'm much more pedestrian in my view. I think, you know, the stuff that excites me is things like same day pay. You know, if we're going to run an economy of gig workers, the least we can do is pay them on the fucking day that they do the work, or in real time, minute by minute, as they clock it in. So right now we have the worst of all possible worlds. Sorry about my language, by the way. I'm sure you'll.
Oh, my editor can bleep that out. That's no problem.
As you can see, I get passionate about this sort of stuff. I mean, right now we have a system whereby, you know, Uber drivers have to bring the factory to work. If it breaks, it's their fault. Mm. It's their problem to deal with. And we're still not paying them in real time. Amazon workers still not getting paid in real time, you know, and so we've got all of the worst. We're giving them all of the income volatility. We're not even giving their income. So moving from a world where people get paid in 2-week shifts or monthly shifts and getting paid in real time, why can't you go and do a day's work and get paid as you're working? That would solve some problems. So a lot of the areas that I'm kind of interested in fintech are not overtly the sexiest, but to me they're kind of more important.
Yeah, that makes a huge amount of sense. Dan, it's been a pleasure chatting to you. Tell us a bit more about the book before you go then, so we can get it in all good bookshops. We get that on Amazon, etc.
Yes, all good bookshops, if bookshops still exist. But online, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere books are sold, wherever you like to pick up your books from, there's an audio book, there's an ebook, and there's a hardback book. It's published by HarperCollins. It's called The Money Hackers, How a Team of a Group of Misfits took on Wall Street and changed finance forever. It's a good read. I can promise you that. It is not technological. It's really about the fascinating individuals who brought this revolution to life, many of whom, as you said at the top of this conversation, you know, are not finance people or even technologists. They're sort of wacky individuals, college dropouts, Somali refugees, music industry aficionados. One guy invented the category of soft rock before he invented the world's largest bank for the underbanked. So, you know, I tried to build a book that was come for the innovators, stay for the innovation. And each chapter is broken down into two or three of these individual stories. So it's extremely easy to pick up and put down. And I hope everyone enjoys reading it as much as I enjoy putting it together.
Hey, we'll put a link in our show notes so our listeners can grab a copy nice and easily as well. But Dan, thanks for your time. That was a pleasure.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Dan for joining us for this episode of Informed Choice Radio. Do check out his book. It's called The Money Hackers. It's a really, really good read, really interesting read. So I do recommend that one. And of course, you can find links and useful notes in our show notes. As always, that's icradio.co.uk. How has fintech changed your life? I'd love to hear from you. Drop me a line via the usual channels. But until next time, I'm Martin Bamford, and this is Informed Choice Radio. And remember, when it comes to your money, the more you know, the faster it can grow.